Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, anger hits boiling point as residents say Johannesburg is collapsing even further. Time is up for business. Fail to register your building's energy performance and you'll face serious legal heat. A major green light for the Cape Winelands Airport, and high-tech toys and nostalgic favorites are flying off the shelves before Christmas. But parents warn this holiday season is a big budget battle. It's Friday, the 31st of October. Let's begin our program with local politics, and it's fairly clear that Johannesburg is in visible decline. Water systems failing, roads crumbling, sewage flowing in some suburbs and townships alike, and residents are now stepping in and fixing infrastructure themselves, organizing security, cleaning streets and marching because they believe the state has collapsed. There's deep anger, there's growing suspicion that politics, all politics, has failed the city. Well, the party Rise Mzansi says it represents a new generation of leadership that listens and delivers, but residents are asking a simple question. Where's the action and why should they trust any politician right now? Well, let's discuss that with Vuyiswa Ramakgopa, who's the national chairperson of Rise Mzansi. A very warm welcome to you. Do you think it's too late to save the city of Johannesburg?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to all your listeners. I absolutely do not think it's too late. And in fact, I think now is the time. It's more urgent than ever that we get stuck in as residents, as political actors, political voices, civic society, and the media, of course. Johannesburg is, it's not too late to save Johannesburg, and we need to fight for our city.
Many residents are sick and tired of political actors, though.
Well, I think there has been, over the last 10, one might even say 10 to 15 years, significant instability and disruption in the politics of the city, which has bred a level of distrust, notwithstanding the coalition dynamics, the various motions of no confidence, the rotating mayoral seat. I think citizens rightfully feel frustrated and distrustful of politics in the city.
And what they're doing now is they're simply bypassing politics, and residents and businesses are often just doing it for themselves. Do you think we've reached a point where people should formally bypass the city and just run certain functions themselves?
I think that a government needs to be in partnership with the citizens. It's not about the citizens taking on everything themselves, because we pay rates. We make contributions to the city, and we deserve to have services delivered. So that aspect is not debatable. What needs to happen is that you need to have a functional government, a professionalized civil service that can actually deliver on its mandate. There is a role that the citizens can play. For example, matters of keeping the city clean. It's not just up to the state institutions. That yes, they must do their part, but citizens should also do their part. There needs to be behavioral change campaigns that are run in different communities and ensure that people don't litter, and that when people see things that are wrong, that they speak up. So it's really about a partnership between government, between the citizens, and a commitment to make the city better.
How would you see that partnership playing out? The private sector says, for instance, it cannot plan because the city is unreliable. Give us a practical example of how you might see that partnership playing out and succeeding.
Well, there have actually been numerous examples, and probably some of the better known ones relate to the city improvement districts and the various city improvement district models that have been rolled out over the years in the CBD. Braamfontein, for example, is one of them, which of course is an area that's largely anchored by students. But once we started to see more private investment in terms of better quality private landlords in the area and more communication with the city and the formation of that city improvement district. It's resulted in a visible improvement in the general look and feel of the area, increased security levels in the area, and better coordination between government and the private sector. And there have been other models in the past, for example, would have seen areas like Maboneng, which of course has gone through its ups and downs, but was at some point a shining star of what can happen when the city and private investment
all
meet each other.
Well and good, but there's an economic imperative in the two areas that you've just listed. In poorer areas, people simply feel abandoned. So what would your party's message be to township residents who say, for instance, politicians only pitch up when their cameras and do nothing else?
Well, I think the need for service delivery is not determined by where someone lives. Whether you are in an upmarket area or a township, we need to still be delivering services at an equal level. And citizens still have a role to play. So examples that I've made again, that I referenced earlier, if, for example, you are going to be cleaning up areas or cleaning up illegal dumping sites, it's important that the community is part of that and ensuring that it does not arise again. And we've seen examples of campaigns. In fact, through our own department right now, as Rise Mzansi, I'm leading the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. We are in a partnership with the Department of Environment, where we have gone to different communities in areas such as Cosmo City, in areas such as Noordgezicht and Orange Farm. And we have asked the residents to identify areas where illegal dumping is happening. And then we will bring some equipment to do the first major cleanup. But then we get into an agreement that they maintain the area and, in fact, also convert some of these former illegal dumping sites into sites of agricultural production, so community gardens.
Right. Let me ask you this question, because time is running against us. You've said the Democratic Alliance's choice of Helen Ziller for Johannesburg mayor is, and I quote you, insulting to local capability. What does that mean?
What it means is that Helen Ziller is not a resident of Johannesburg and hasn't been for many years. That's number one. Number two, this idea that we have to export talent from somewhere else to come and fix and rescue the helpless residents of Johannesburg is inherently flawed. What is needed is a cohort of leaders who can work together and also work with citizens to get the city moving again. This is not in any way to slight Helen Ziller's capabilities, but to say Johannesburg is the epicenter of human capital, of talent. We have people at all levels of society leading in so many different industries, in so many different ways. What is needed is to be able to create an ability for those people to participate in politics and to raise their hands also to get involved.
Right.
We need better councillors. We have multiple mayoral committees. So MMCs, for example, have a role to play. They lead specific portfolios. One individual cannot resolve that. What we need to do is ensure that we have a cohort of leaders in the city that are credible, that are competent. We know they are there.
And you'd so like to lead that cohort. Are you Rise Mzansi's candidate for mayor?
No, I am not. As you know, Rise Mzansi has merged with the Good Party and Bosa.
I'm aware of that. Would you like to be Unite for Change's candidate for the mayorship of the city of Johannesburg?
Well, we haven't made that decision yet. We haven't announced our candidates at all yet. I just want to see somebody who actually lives in the city, number one, running the city. But number two, of course, somebody who's capable, who's competent, and who's here for the long haul.
But you're not ruling out the possibility that your name is in the frame.
No, I wouldn't rule out the possibility, but as I'm saying, we haven't run the process, so it's very difficult for me to anoint myself the incoming mayor of Johannesburg.
Fair
I wouldn't
point.
Do that.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Vuyiswa Ramakgopa, National Chairperson of Rise Mzansi.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's push towards energy efficiency has gained, I think, some real legal teeth. Private commercial buildings larger than 2,000 square meters and state buildings over 1,000 have now got to register for something called an Energy Performance Certificate by December next year. failure to comply, and companies could face fines of up to 5 million rand or even jail time. So that's fairly onerous. The greater goal, I guess, is better transparency, lower emissions, and more energy efficient building. But many businesses still don't understand the rules or the risks. Well, let's break it down for you. I'm in conversation now with the legal director at the law firm Pinsent Masons, Naina Kara. A very warm welcome. Maybe let's start simply. What exactly is the certificate, and why is government enforcing it now rather than years ago? I guess one's got to ask.
Thanks, Jeremy. An EPC, or an energy performance certificate, is basically a certificate which is telling us how efficient a building is in using its energy. And this is something which government has actually had in the pipeline for some time. So it was initially introduced around 2020, with the initial deadline being 2022. And this has now subsequently moved out to actually 7th of December 2025. So just to correct that, buildings need to have the certificate in place as of 2025, this year, 7th of December. Mm. And the reason why it is important is because government is now trying to align ourselves with international best practice around the built environment. Our buildings alone are responsible for 15% of carbon emissions in this country. So it's trying to bring us, I guess, into the future.
Fair point, and thanks for the clarification. So deadline 7 December 2025. In your view, how many qualifying properties are realistically on track to meet that deadline?
That's unfortunately not a question I can answer, but my gut sense is that there's very few buildings that are on track. I found some material which said in July, as of 2025, there were 7,000 buildings that had been registered. But given the size of South Africa, that's definitely not enough. And I'm pretty sure the uptake is going to be slow. And the reason for that, I think, is because enforcement of this is going to be tricky. These regulations apply to both the private sector as well as organs of state. And the Department of Mineral Energy and Resources is responsible for ensuring compliance. How it's going to ensure compliance, though, is tricky. I mean, I can't see schools, for argument, which are subject to these regulations, all having these certificates in place by the 7th of December, because that would be something the Department of Education would need to be providing these schools. So I think there is a slow uptake because people are aware that the enforcement is going to be an issue on this one.
So enforcement is a problem, but the penalties are severe. I think I mentioned 5 million rand or even imprisonment. So unlikely that we're going to expect aggressive enforcement, but maybe this is more just about signaling and nudging.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the penalties are meant to show that government is serious about this. I think government has to now rethink how it wants to incentivize people to take this up. So instead of punishing people, the corporate sector or the private sector, I think, would have been more incentivized had they been sort of, for instance, a rebate in terms of their rates account, or you even offered tax reductions. So I think government needs to think about how they want to do this to bring people along with them, because unfortunately, the penalty and imprisonment is not something that's worked for us in the past.
I suspect that many business owners will turn around and say it's another compliance burden. How do you respond to the argument that the timing is punitive in a very weak economy?
It is a compliance. I mean, there are quite a few steps that one needs to jump through to find yourself compliant. So I do have sympathy for business owners, especially in this economy. But unfortunately, we've got to start somewhere. And the fact that this has been in the works since 2020, we're now in 2025, given our standing globally and internationally, we have to find ways to catch up. And we have to also start rethinking and reimagining the built environment in South Africa if we don't want to be left behind. So it is a bit of a balancing act.
How much confusion is there about which buildings actually qualify? Are there grey areas that you're seeing from your clients right now?
There is some confusion because the types of buildings at the moment exclude a whole host of things you would normally expect to find in this in terms of these regulations. So, for instance, it doesn't extend to shopping malls, which the man in the street would obviously think is something that we should be complying with. It doesn't, for now, extend to industrial buildings. And my thinking is that government is actually using this as a a test with offices and buildings which it can easily access and has control over. But I am sure that in the coming years, there will be changes made to the regulation where, you know, hospitality and industrial buildings, hospitals, etc., would also need to be compliant.
And Naina, just a final one. What about companies that have invested heavily in energy efficiency in the first place? Does the certificate or the process, the certification process, reward proactive behavior?
Absolutely. So there is no need for a certificate if the building is firstly not older than 2 years or if it has undergone major renovations in the past 2 years, with the thinking that in the past 2 years, one would have had to comply with the updated building standards in any event. So this would only apply, or the certification only applies to buildings which are older than 2 years and which have not undergone major renovations.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Naina Khara, Legal Director at the law firm Pinsent Masons.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you will be well aware that Cape Town will soon have its second major airport. The Cape Winelands Airport has now secured environmental authorization for this 8 billion rand expansion. And what I understand is that it promises jobs, logistics growth and tourism capacity. But obviously, big promises require big answers. Timelines do slip, budgets overrun, infrastructure dreams can stall. And I guess residents also want proof that this isn't just another glossy project that looks good on paper but never actually lands, pun intended. Well, joining me now is the Managing Director of the Cape Winelands Airport, Dion Kluti. A very warm welcome to you. So you must be delighted you've got environmental approval. What does that mean and what happens next?
Hi, Jeremy. Obviously a very, very big moment for us, following what is essentially a four-year journey, two of which was formally within the EIA process. Many consultations, engagements, research, specialist studies, and we have an outcome now where we have received approval in authorization in terms of our environmental application, which essentially gives us the green light to proceed. Obviously, subject still to appeal procedures. If there are any appeals, they still have to be considered and processed. But certainly this is a critical milestone, because the other major issue is the issue of funding. And we've actually already approached the markets during the course of last year. We've appointed our financial transaction advisors, Investec and Waterborne Capital, and they went to market last year. So we have had a number of offers and applications, but all of these were subject to environmental authorization.
Are you able to tell us at this point, Dion, how much funding has actually been secured? 8 billion rand is a big price tag.
It's a big number, Jeremy. And in a previous life, I was quite involved at the time of what's today called the King Shaka Airport development. Mm. I recall that was a 7 billion rand development. What you effectively do is you build an airport that creates the capability to handle at least 1.5 million passengers per annum for a phase one build. The approval allows you to go up to 5 million passengers per annum. Central to this development is a runway of 3.5 kilometers with all associated airfield infrastructure. In essence, we're talking in terms of the airport footprint and the application that has been approved of 466 hectares of land that gets developed. Within that, there's about 350,000 square meters of bulk. And that bulk would then consist out of terminal, hangars, retail, hotels, mm-hmm. offices, and any other property. So it is a proper precinct with fueling infrastructure, fencing, all of the safety and regulatory requirements that you need for an airport.
A question was, how much of that money have you secured?
Our intention, Jeremy, we're looking at a 35-40% split between equity and loan funding. That's where we would like to land. We have had some offers and proposals. We haven't signed any agreements yet. This will be the focus in the next few weeks. We hope to get that all bedded down by the first quarter of next year. And essentially, there will be two rounds. We refer to a round A and B. So the initial round that we're looking at is probably at the order of about $3 to $4 billion, and with the remainder to follow.
You talk about the appeal process, Dion. Residents in the winelands are already concerned, I think it's fair to say, about congestion, noise and environmental impact. Obviously, you've got the authorization now. But nonetheless, how do you respond to critics who say this is going to commercialize and disrupt one of the Western Cape's most treasured regions?
You know, Jeremy, it's always a fair point, because when you do development, and I think from our perspective, we from the word go, and this EI could have probably taken quicker, but we really took our time to make sure that we understand all of the issues. Normally with development, and particularly when you talk about what type of changes there could be, is the issue of noise and airports and the conflicts that there might be on the residential side. We are very fortunate that this airfield is in the farming areas which have not been developed yet. And one of the big positives is that we are able, with the city and particularly in terms of spatial planning, make sure that we don't have future conflicts between land zoning and land use on and around the airport. The specialist studies do show that the only noise impact that could be of a disturbing nature is actually confined to the airport footprint at this stage. Our intention is to keep it like that. When you talk about that, you know, the area at Durbanville, Paarl, Wellington area, that it will change, I think, Jeremy, that's a fair point, but I think it's inevitable. If you look at Cape Town as a growing city, it's going to grow in one direction, north up the N1, and then also the west coast. I mean, that is really the only area where it logically is growing into, and this is where this airport is located. So what it would do is it would create convenient access for a lot more people now and in the future as the city grows towards the airport and beyond the airport. Mm.
You've promised, if I've read this correctly, 35,000 jobs. What percentage of those are guaranteed local jobs rather than outsourced contractors or even imported specialist labor?
Yeah, so that's, you know, the first person or the first entities we sat down with when we started this journey was with the communities, and particularly the more vulnerable communities. We have two particular communities in very, very close proximity, Pisanta Kraal and also Klipjeville. I must say, during the course of this journey of ours, we were able to build a very good relationship, not just with the councillors, but with the community leaders. And the way we're looking at this, Jeremy, we're saying to all of our contractors and suppliers, if you don't show and demonstrate to us how you're going to uplift, train, employ from these communities, we will not be taking you serious. It really is an environment. We have other developments that are happening in that area right now, which are extremely positive. There's the new university campus that's going up or that's been opened up. There's the new shopping center. So a lot more people that historically used to travel long distances to get to a place of work, they find work now closer, and we hope to accelerate that. No doubt, Jeremy, there are some, particularly when you're at a contract stage, when you implement specialized navigational systems, baggage systems, fuel systems, you have to rely on specialist resources that come from elsewhere. But again, we're going to follow a model where we use those opportunities for these entities to also bring local people into the mix so that we can transfer skills and build capacity of our own.
Dion Clutie, thank you very much indeed. Managing Director of the Cape Winelands Airport.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South African families are heading into the festive season with mixed emotions, I think. A lot of excitement, but also tighter budgets and real pressure on household spending. Yet the toy sector is still signaling strong demand. The latest Toys R Us Christmas list provides a mix of tech, creativity, nostalgia, that's interesting, and value options. So I'm wondering what these trends tell us about consumer confidence and festive behavior. Well, joining me now is Catherine Jacoby, Marketing Manager at Toys R Us South Africa. Catherine, welcome to you. It's a tough economy. How difficult is it to balance premium must-have toys with price-sensitive options for families these days?
Yes, thanks, Jeremy, for having me. It is such a wonderful time of the year to chat about a topic like this. And I think it is a sign of the times that parents are looking for product that is affordable, that can fit their budgets but still providing joy to their children. And we are seeing a bit of a balance. You know, there is obviously the customer that is on the upper end of the scale that can afford the higher price points, but we ensure that there is something for everybody. And the festive season is about bringing that joy and that magic into the home, whether that toy is a tiny little thing or a building block set or an expensive Barbie doll. We make sure that there's something for everyone.
Let's talk a little about messaging. We see some high ticket items on this year's list, things like ride-ons and drones and consoles. But what would your message be to parents who feel that festive gifting is simply becoming unaffordable these days?
My message would be that bringing a smile to a child's face doesn't need to be expensive. It can be as simple as a little toy. It can be as simple as you playing role play or story time with a child. And I think that it comes down to the simple things. Toys that inspire imagination, a simple game of hide and seek. So play doesn't need to be expensive. It's actually a fundamental developmental tool as part of a child's growth and in order for them to thrive in life.
Interesting that one of your trends is nostalgia, Catherine. How's that playing out?
Nostalgia is a big trend in the toy world. We're seeing almost 35% of global toy sales being adult purchases of toys for themselves. And there is this sense of escapism to their childhood and toys where times were happier. They sort of, you know, don't want to deal with the hard truths of their current, share their experiences with their children. So what they used to play with, they almost want to introduce their child to that. And the nostalgic part is really, really magical. We're seeing Funko Pops. We're seeing the likes of all of the Ninja Turtles come back and toys that are really have a collectible nature.
It's also a sign, though, that parents are maybe choosing sentimentality over a lot of fast-moving consumer hype that we see these days.
Yes, they are. They are. And I think it is, we almost need to simplify that. It's not about the AI and the latest trends all the time. It's about simply having product or toys that can spark connection between you and your child and quality time with your child. And that is a big driver of what we do, is communicating the power of play and what play actually means.
Catherine, explain to an old baby boomer here the attraction of the so-called blind box toys. Why are they booming?
Blind boxes is a big hit. So we even saw, we partnered with Comic-Con earlier this year, and blind boxing is everywhere. So the excitement around blind boxing is all about that element of surprise and the collectability nature of the product. So you want to, the product is obviously closed in its encasing, and you don't know what product you're going to get. So there is a level of anticipation, the unknown, and then when you do get the character, you almost collect and trade with each other. So if you get a double, you end up trading with a friend at school, or you'll see on the Facebook groups the moms are doing big swaps with all of the collectible products, and it can actually have an extended play pattern. So although the unboxing only happens once, there's an extended play pattern beyond that with blind boxing toys.
And tell me, just in terms of distribution of merchandise, what's the balance like between people going to stores and e-commerce? Because we know these days same day delivery is a big want. Do you think the digital convenience is lowering costs for consumers, or are they primarily looking for maybe speed over experience?
So we see a balance of both. E-commerce last year was just under 30% growth year on year. So we definitely see the consumer spending more online from a convenience perspective. Like you mentioned, we've also launched same day delivery to ensure that we are competitive and we are giving the customer the convenience and speed that they need. But you cannot replace a child's experience of walking through a toy store. It is an absolute dream. Their eyes light up. And I think it is about finding the balance between the two, specifically in our industry, bringing magic to life and actually experiencing the product themselves is really something that you can't replicate online. So we find the child still visiting the store, but the parent finding the convenience being to shop online.
Just a final one, based on what you're seeing in store and online, are you discerning anything about this year's toy season and what it's telling you about South African consumer confidence going into next year?
We're still seeing the customer spending. This is a, like I mentioned, it is an emotional purchase. Christmas isn't going anywhere. It's a birthday and a Christmas event or Diwali or an event where there's gifting involved. It is an emotional purchase. So your mind sort of finds a way and your pocket finds a way, whether it be a smaller purchase this year than last year. It still brings joy, and it's not something that you skimp on. You don't skimp on your children. You always first compromise on yourself before you compromise on bringing joy and smiles to those little faces. So I think we're heading into a big season for us, and no doubt it will be a big period for us too.
I can't believe it's just the end of October and we've just done our first Christmas season interview. Catherine Jacoby, thank you very much indeed. Marketing Manager at Toys R Us South Africa. And that's where we are going to leave it for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.